Taking this Parliament, Tuesday, 1st of June, second reading of the Appropriation Bill 2014, budget speaking continues.
The Honourable Minister James McClinton.
Mr. Speaker, it is with great pleasure that I stand to deliver my 19th budget address. I will commence with matters to do with utility first, followed by the environment, and lastly, health and safety. Mr. Speaker, in relation to the power station, this is an area of concern due to the government's inability to prioritize the work of an important project, which is the new power station. As we have stated on a number of times, the new incoming government had the right not to proceed with the previous year's government project in relation to the power station, even when initial clearance work had already started. But to be in a position only 3 years after being elected, we have a clear position with regard to the growth of future needs with regard to power supply in a safe manner, given the site chosen is incredible. The Honourable Chief Minister's motion for not pursuing the GST government scheme for new permanent power station is down to having continued with the GST scheme, we would have been starting with £120 million project, but it was in the wrong location, or not the best available technology in environmentally friendly options, or the consumer would have had massive increases in the year for consumption. The reality, Mr. Speaker, is that when the Chief Minister quotes the £120 million, he is deliberately obfuscating the fact that such amount was for a complete package inclusive of £20 million for associated infrastructure work as opposed to the plan to serve. The plan also included a new office block for Jubilee. The location surely would not have been as bad as placing, say, a new football stadium at the Nova Point, which the Chief Minister is adamant in doing, come hell or high water. As far as technology is concerned, within the different types of engines, they were the best available technology at the time as advised by the experts. Or is the Chief Minister going to contradict the advice given to us by officials and experts in this field then? In addition to this, the IPCC committee which deals with such matters pursuant to European legislation approved the scheme. We then make an apology for the fact that based on grounds of safety, we ruled out having a dual fire plant run by diesel and gas. We do believe then and now that placing liquefied natural gas storage tanks so near to an area which is densely populated is a mistake and we are prepared to fail. And frankly, even if we need to pay more money in order to a higher standard of health and safety to avoid an accident ever happening in the proximity of residential estates within the western of the water, which would have colossal consequences if it ever were to happen, we would do it. On the other hand, the Chief Minister is not in a position to speak to anyone about value for money, given that he has lost control of return expenditure under his work as Chancellor. This is a typical example of the pot calling the kettle black. The government also needs to be transparent in the way the government handles projects of this kind. Throughout the period of this government, I have been asking in Parliament on numerous occasions for all relevant copies of technical, environmental, and health and safety reports, only to be stonewalled with evasive answers in order to deny a member of the petition from being able to scrutinize the government on such an important project for the voter. Mr. Speaker, it is inconceivable that such an attitude would prevail in the House of Commons, the Scottish Parliament, or the Welsh Assembly, or indeed in any municipality across the United Kingdom. Any project of this kind in any part of the UK would allow automatically the members of the petition with instant access to all relevant information in order to allow proper scrutiny of the executive. However, here in Gibraltar, the view that prevails by the government is that accountability and transparency lies in the number of occasions that Parliament meets. as opposed to being concerned on his action in Parliament by providing the opposition with information and speech in order to have a debate on equal terms. Speaker, moving on, lack of a holistic plan. Another issue of concern that needs to be highlighted is the whole approach by government in relation to projects that either are of the government or private ones which are to be developed in close proximity to each other in the west side of Gibraltar and the port area. In order to illustrate this point, we have a solid plan to be operated again at a North Mole in close proximity of the cruise liner. Liquefied natural gas storage tanks to be placed in the detached mole. Specific bunkering from the detached mole. Laying of pipes on the seafloor connecting the liquefied natural gas storage tanks to the new power station, a new power station, and a new boat marina. And along the perimeter of all these projects, we have an airport on one side, housing estate, including a new one to be built in the former fleet site, and on the other side, a nuclear burst submarine. Not to mention the movement of cruise liners either inside the port or outside. Yet the government approach to this matter is cavalier, awkward, covered in secrecy, and dangerous. On a number of occasions, I have asked the government and parliament if they have undertaken a specialist holistic analysis of all the developments within this area in order to protect the public, only to be informed by the Deputy Chief Minister that such a study is not necessary, and each individual project is considered on its own merit as a development and planning commission. In truth, we in the opposition are not the only ones calling for this approach to development in this whole area. The environmental safety group is also advocating the same. Yet, while the argument is compelling to do so for the good of the environment and for health and safety matters, the government refuses to do so. It is bogus belief that the government is so incompetent on such an important matter that has the potential to put people's lives at risk through their stubbornness. Speaker, moving to the environment and an expenditure, I noticed that the sum estimated and required in the year ending 31st of March 2015 for salaries, wages, and expenses of the environment, as reflected in Health 14 Environment, is of £12,852,000. This is the figure is £1,453,000 less than the estimate for the financial year 2013-14. This is in large measure due to the fact that Subhead 2 relief cover are shown in page 55 of the draft estimate book, amounting to a total of £1,938,000 have been transferred to a private company called Gibraltar Cleaning Services Limited under the control of the Employment Ministry of Germany, page 56 of the draft estimate book. Therefore, given the significant reorganization of funds away from the management of the environment department, it requires a proper explanation by the government as to why this has been deemed necessary. I certainly look forward to listening why there has been a need for this and how such a decision will improve or hinder the services that the Department of Environment needs to provide, although I noticed that the Minister, from his very brief speech yesterday, he did not mention anything about this. The other point I would like to make about the expenditure, Mr. Speaker, is that even if we add the total amount for the Department as shown in the draft of £10,863,000, plus the £1,938,000 transferred to the private company under the control of the Employment Department, this brings a grand total of £14,800,000. This is £710,970 more than the actual expenditure under the last full financial year of the GOV government during 2010-11. So even after adjusting for inflation during this intervening period, this is the sum requested by the Minister for his department in comparable amount to that under the GOV government. Amazing fact, given that what one gets from the Minister for Environment is constant rubbishing of the GOV period in government. For the Honourable Minister, it is all down to either the GOV did not do anything for the environment, or if he did, he was all wrong and bad. This despite the fact that he was the GOV government vice at the time and never felt necessary to resign on principle from those duties then, from the horrendous things he says now. We thank you for the opportunity on behalf of your petition to congratulate Dr. Mathilio, Dr. Lisa and Mr. Whatever, for now holding the position of Chief Executive of the Department. I know Lisa well, and I am aware of how capable she is. We in the DSC are extremely proud that Lisa was a special digital employee in order to create a new department of environment, given that the years ago before us did not believe in having such a department, nor employing 90% of the current staff that the assistant minister now has at his disposal. But of course, we will not expect recognition by the minister. Mr. Speaker, moving on to renewable energy. As I did last year, I would like to start by giving credit where credit is due to start with, then moving on with things that have not been that great and finalizing the things that have gone badly. One of the most exciting things that has materialized in the last 12 months, at least for me, is the government agreement with the company Echoway's Ocean Power plant for the provision of a new 0.5 megawatt energy device on the east side with a view to further expansion to a full 5 megawatt plant if the project is successful. This being a technology based on harnessing surface wave energy by use of specific oils to cut down from there such energy. I noted the words in the government statement of quote, if the project is successful, unquote. And I can understand why this is so. The reality is that we are talking by and large of new technologies that need to be tried and tested in situ. And I think this is the right approach. Needless to say, all of us in this chamber would like this project to succeed for the benefit of our community. These and other technologies were followed with great interest in my days while I was the environment minister, but unfortunately the technologies have not developed sufficiently enough to warrant being introduced into Gibraltar back then in those days. Clearly, with the passage of time, more and more technologies are becoming available. And whilst I noted the minister's point to my question about underwater current technology not being available for another 10 years or so, we should never stop in being kept abreast of development in these fields, as I believe this will have the potential of giving a tremendous boost to a constant source of clean renewable energy for the future. The speaker on nothing for the municipal waste station and fiscal and sensible environment. Credit to should be given for the closing of the net over the municipal waste transfer station of the Oak Advanced Road, thereby, according to the minister, no longer having an issue of rubbish flying out from the south onto the surrounding coast or sea. I am pleased that the minister takes notice to my question on this matter from time ago and of the actual solution to this historical problem. Also, to be welcome is the continuation of the GSE policy to use fiscal incentive methods as a means to make more environmentally friendly products more accessible to the public. Speaker, moving on to beaches, another project that seems to have gone well and it is almost complete is the work in Sandy Bay, both in relation to the construction of the two grounds and the submit breakwater one, along with the regeneration of the beach itself. This new ground will be enjoyed by many members of the public, hopefully for many years to come. Additionally, any extra biodiversity of marine life that's clustered in the surrounding area is to be welcomed too. Another area to be welcomed is the continual funding by staff members of the Department of Environment in the European Parliament, the latest of which was in Greece in relation to matters to do with loss of biodiversity under the Natura 2000 programme. Such participation is important for our delegates in order to make aware other delegates of the particulars of our environment within the much wider picture of the Mediterranean and Europe. It is also an opportunity to extend our networking with other professionals in the field, thereby complementing the overall objective. Yes, Mr. Speaker, while we have progress on one beach, we have stalemate on another, which is Western Beach. Clearly, to have progress in resolving the problems in Western Beach, it could only have been by pursuing two different avenues, the political, the legal, or both simultaneously. The political has remained a non-stop as far as the Lalina municipality is concerned, given that they do not have the necessary funds to do the infrastructural work needed, nor it seems from a regional basis as regards the Junta and Andalusia. The Junta, just as all other regional governments in Spain, have been subjected to substantial cutbacks in their budget from the group as a result of the economic crisis, thereby being unable to provide such funding. Finally, on the political front, it seems that engaging Madrid is also a non-starter, given that the relations between the Madrid government and Gibraltar is toxic and will remain so for some considerable time to come. On the legal side, the Honourable Minister for the Environment has kept me informed confidentially of developments on the legal front. Unfortunately, this is a long and convoluted process, but the only one available to us right now. I certainly am grateful to him for keeping me abreast of developments, and the Minister for Fishing will continue to conduct himself responsibly on this matter, placing the interests of the community first, which is the contrary to when the current government of the opposition conducted orchestrated campaigns against the NGC government, along with a friendly media press, for not pursuing the matter with speed and vigor, something to exactly what is happening today. The speaker, moving on to waste and wastewater treatment plans. These are also important and sensitive projects of water, namely the waste treatment plant and the wastewater treatment plant. But the picture emanating is one of delays between the government informing the public of such projects and the commencement of that. Again, something that from the very brief picture the minister had nothing to say yesterday. Take the case of the waste treatment plant. The government informed the press way back in February 2013, you can see the developer point of the 16th of February 2013, of a decision to provide a new plant at the site of the old incinerator at the Europa Bank Road in order to treat the solid municipal waste with environmentally friendly technology. The Honourable Minister himself has had the consultant report on himself since January 2013, and only last month, some 18 months later, the Minister responded to a written question to inform me that the tender is still under assessment. The Honourable Minister knows that we have been taking our municipal waste in the past and in the present to the recycling plant in the Guadalupe. This is a procedure which is fraught with problems not least because of the impending compliance with the EU landfill directive for the amount of biodegradable waste that can be allowed into the landfill. Yet, Mr. Speaker, when I look at the draft of this book, I do not see any entry for the commencement of this important project. The government needs to inform Parliament whether this project will commence in this financial year or whether it's going to be paid from the Conservative Fund or from Credit Finance Limited or indeed from any other source. The same applies, Mr. Speaker, to how the government decides to proceed with the disposal of fuel. As we are aware, we want to continue to discharge resources into the sea from prevention or EU directives in this matter. The government needs to make clear by when it will decide to award the tender for the proper treatment of raw food prior to discharging into the sea. Quite apart from doing so, for good environmental reasons, we risk giving those that want to harm the water with a perfect opportunity to tarnish their reputation as well. The government needs to inform the Parliament whether the delay of implementation of this project, the British government is incurring fines from the European Union or likely to happen anytime soon. Also, whether the government intends to proceed with this project, given that there is no provision within the draft estimate, or perhaps it will, but by using money indirectly from the surplus of the savings bank via Credit Finance Limited. Either way, the government needs to say what is happening in this important area of the environment. It has been over 2 years since the now infamous episode of government policy being placed in Facebook, the statement by the Honourable Minister of Environment announcing that the laws of Gibraltar were to be enforced properly and that illegal fishing in British Gibraltar territorial water would be stopped as per the current manifesto movement. An announcement since to be by the no lesser body than the Chamber of Commerce of the Rookie Era. An announcement which can't be brought into the dispute, which still has no signs of resolution. We have the unprecedented case of an unnecessary crisis that erupted in March 2012, which has seen the unabated fishing in a water by the Spanish fishing fraternity and a crescendo of hostility as a result of the government's incompetence in handling such delicate matters. The current position in the state has been that our laws need to be respected by the Spanish fishermen. Yes, this is amazing that when our chief minister was asked in the recent release program of the Hondo Contestor as to why this some fishermen recognize the opportunity of fishing our waters, the chief minister responded by saying that the fishermen were fishing without any hindrance. Given that the chief minister's response, one is entitled to ask why then the 1999 agreement was broken without notice, only to provide the fishermen with a license to do whatever the fishermen decide to do, regardless of the laws passed by this government. Why then can't you vote into a crisis of your own making, with the consequences being paid by every people on both sides of the frontier? The public is entitled to know until when is this crisis going to be prolonged, and when is the government going to resolve the crisis it started? The speaker, moving on to Badrin Matai. An important area where the minimum buying is simply problem alone is with the problems of the Badrin Matai. Within the figures provided by the minister in terms of the population of the Matai, we see that the high level rate of population was in 2006 with 242 Matai, followed by 241 in 2007 and in 2008. Following on from these figures, the population started to drop to 212 in 2009, 182 in 2010, and in the last year reduced to 175 in 2011. So what then is the feature we observe under the watch of the current minister, although I should argue that the watch of the minister has existed for the last 20 years or so, in which the only minister used to be the previous advisor on this matter. Well, in 2012, the population started to increase again to 183 from 175. Then, in 2013, it grew to 206. And in 2014, the figure was 225, although this figure needs to be adjusted for possible further growth and death for the remainder of the year. So, tentatively, under the words of the current minister, the population has increased by a further 50. Taking the situation back to the level that existed in 2004. So while the population of Macau decreased under the last years of the GSA government, now it is increasing again under the GSA liberal government. So why then did the population drop by 67 in the last few years of the GSA government, and why has the population increased by 50 in the 2.5 years of the present government? The answer lies in the fact that in the last few years of the GSA government, a program of planning was implemented due to the difficulties in exporting of the Macaque, which would have been otherwise a preferred option. But planning has been ruled out by the second government due to the brilliant campaign waged by the chief liberal opposition in tandem with animal rights organizations in the UK in order to challenge the government of the voter abroad for their own selfish, partisan interest over the interests of this community. The irony of the situation, Mr. Speaker, is that we have a minister who has studied and written about Badrin Matai for the last 20 to 30 years, yet today he has not released the Gibraltar Matai management plan in order for the public to know what the minister's objectives in this area are. On the 1st of March 2013, the Times newspaper carried an article in which the minister informed them that his water plan would be exporting Matai to Morocco, Tunisia, Safari Park, in the UK, and the EU, in order to alleviate the overpopulation problem in Gibraltar. Nonetheless, when I asked the minister recently whether there had been any exploitation in Macau, the answer was no exploitation has taken place. So some 15 months later, the minister has not exported any Macau. We have a population in the rise, despite the new contraceptive scheme introduced under the current government. We have more parts of Macau placing than ever before, all conducting itself into new groups or subgroups searching for other areas closer to everyone in order to settle. And all the minister does is talk and more experts and the creation of more and more management committees. At this rate, soon we will have a new interministerial committee with participation with Macaque to study for the study to resolve the problems of all populations with meetings to be arranged perhaps as a fund donor with extensive paper number 6 currently. The findings of all these meetings can then be submitted for consideration to the never-be-published Gibraltar Matai Management Plan for the eventual reduction of the macaque overpopulation. Oh boy, talking about kicking the phone into the long grass. Another failure within the policy of the minister with regards to macaque is the enforcement of the new legislation for eradicating the illegal feeding of macaque, either in the nature reserve or outside. Despite much publicity with regards to the illegality about feeding the monkeys, with press statements and literature about how macaque behavior has been changed with feeding the monkeys, the wrong food or overfeeding them, the only person closest for feeding the macaque has been one tourist. This is how the minister, expects to end this unacceptable practice. What is the point of new laws when there is a huge gap between the law and enforcement? What is the point of therapeutically bringing through the back door to new environmental protection officers with powers to enforce the provisions of wildlife wardens under the Nature Protection Act when the illegality of feeding the macaque goes on unabated? And though this is not enough, the minister commenced a strategy to get the monkeys back to the nature reserve, which imported into the water illegal male pyrotechnics from Spain that does not comply with European legislation. The minister, when informed about this in Parliament, adopted the attitude of seeking advice on a matter as a form of kicking another ball into the long grass. Quite frankly, why doesn't the minister think it is guilty to be charged and take penalty on the ground that is actually not able to placate the public outcry and macaque occupation of urban human areas? The fact that the minister has adopted the natural sciences does not mean that he is admitting. Yet I have no doubt that when the chief minister, in his vote of reply time, he will continue to say that all of these were in the GSU fault, and that we will, in due course, put things right. At least, we can make a start by targeting the water macaque management plan, so that the public can be the judge of their policies in this important matter. But transparency and accountability is not one of the government's forces. But why bother with transparency and accountability when we have no meetings of Parliament, Mr. Speaker? Speaker, moving to enforcement of local regulations. Back in 2013, the Minister of Environment announced to much fanfare a new emphasis in the fight to clamp on people living in the streets by revamping the litter committee and by introducing much harder fines to ensure that these practices would get eradicated. At the time, I remember thinking, well, perhaps the minister is serious about stamping this practice by penalizing such offenders with heavy fines. I think they also allow some time to monitor progress. But recently, I asked for the number of litter tickets issued by either the IGP, the environmental agency, or the highest enforcement officer. And the response was that to date only 6 such tickets have been issued between 2013 and 2014. Again, we found ourselves in the same predicament as in the situation of Macaque. The minister talks tough, makes many promises, but when it comes to action, he is found wanting and certainly not making any difference to the state of our pavement in which many members of the public need to keep safe very carefully in order not to get stuck in dark foul. The fact that the only minister does not, this is the fact that the only minister doesn't need to go far to find the evidence, as he has his faith in front of some very hospital and in other places. Speaker, calling the people. Another subject not mentioned by the minister is very interesting. Here again, the minister has lost control of events. Looking at the figures provided by the minister in Parliament, we have the following facts. In 2009, Gorm carried 4,552 people, and the then federal company 3,812, making the total of the year of 8,374. In 2010, Gorm's carried 4,025, and federal 5,508. Making a total of the year of 9,583. In 2011, Gorm's carried 3,491 and Sarah 5,708, making a total of the year of 9,199. In 2012, Gorm's carried 3,381 and Sarah 3,694, making it a total of the year of 6,085. It should be said that the reason why Sarah only called 2,694 in that year was because the minister decided to terminate the contract with Sarah on the ground that the work involved could easily be done by God. Therefore, the amount of money voted in Parliament for the work carried out by Sarah, over £110,000, in the financial year 2012-2013, moved practically in totality to Cohen in the financial year 2013-14, making a total of £207,000 for the purpose of carrying speakers. Yet, when we look at the figures of speakers carried in 2013 by Cohen alone, it amounts to 2,649 carried by Cohen for the year. These being less than the figures carried by Cohen in 2012, which amounted to 3,391. Yet, with a combined budget of what Cohen and Sarah had in the previous year. Whereas, the focus item for the financial year 2013-14 is expected to be £131,000. This means that for more money being paid with Cohen, the public gets less figures carried. And if the figures for the end of 14, April 2014 get extrapolated, for the end of the year, 2014 will be worse than 2013. Mr. Speaker, what could have happened in this period for the Minister of Environment to have less desire in the vote? It might have been the time spent on a vanity garden project in Queensland. What excuses will the Honourable Minister come up with? Blame the GSC again for things happening under his watch? Come up with another committee of experts to provide the Minister with a mansion plan for the colony of people? Or will he counter attack by stealing some scientific rhetoric to cover his inaction on this matter? Clearly, the minister does not have a clue on achieving value for money for the taxpayer, not to mention the members of the public whose life is blighted by the massive overpopulation of creatures. The speaker, moving to the state of the botanical garden. Again, another subject not mentioned by the minister on his very brief speech. The consequences of the minister losing sight of his environmental responsibility doesn't just remain on the issue of seagulls and macaques. It extends to the dilapidated state of the botanic garden. Despite the constant grandiosity of comments to which everyone is subjected to his alleged single-handedness in restoring the Alameda Gardens with graphic illustration of him speaking in despair by the flowerbed capstone, making everyone listening satisfied, that the minister leaves out of the story that what he heard of them was the prioritization of the maintenance of the garden by the so-called socialist chief minister, who had not invested in the Alameda Garden for 8 years. Note that the last budget passed from the GSC garden was an amount of £854,000 from the pickings that was provided by the GSC garden. Note that the minister gave recognition to the hard work made by the staff who have worked there for years. According to the minister, all the merit is to be reflected by the action of one person, the minister himself. For him, this is a story about I and not you. Yet, what is the story today in the Botanic Garden? It is the deplorable conditions of the country, and in particular to Grand Parade Ward. It is also the deplorable state of the street furniture within the garden. No doubt, the minister, I can see the Honourable Minister Mr. Lamar is laughing in nervousness about what I'm telling him. Perhaps he has something to say about it. But I think he could have the courtesy, of allowing me to finish. Not that the minister gives us, well, I've said that. It is the deplorable condition of the parties and in particular to the Grand Parade Ward. It is also the deplorable state of the six furniture within the garden. Note that the minister reminds you that this too is the GSC fault, based on some fanciful arguments about measuring the growth of the roots of trees in the 15 years in which the GSC was in government. Never mind the person that the person in charge of the maintenance of the garden then, who today is the minister, never bothered to do anything about it. Never mind that in almost 3 years as the Minister for Environment, he has abandoned responsibility for the condition of the botanic garden. And never mind that in the draft estimate book, there is no provision for the necessary work to be done in this financial year. But of course, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister has been too busy in his vanity part in Queensland to have time to provide the public that goes to the end of the garden with reasonable standards of facility. So how can the Minister rescue himself from this procedure? Create another committee to be called the Botanic Garden Management Plan, And 2 months before the next election, he can then have the waistband and even get the bigger picture for the next manifesto. I can even see what the heading of the story in the manifesto will be. But that is that investment from the richer GOP legacy. Mr. Speaker, moving on to landscaping and planting of trees. Moving on to the subject of planting trees, which in some ways overlaps with the botanic garden, but obviously it is much broader. Here again, the minister is keen to blame his comfort at the amount of trees planted during the period of the present government. Yet, what the minister will not do is to provide Parliament with two figures of trees cut to a developer with the serious argument that one cannot differentiate the trees from the grass. But what is more worryingly is that there is no coherent plan for landscaping throughout Gibraltar, particularly when it comes to the planting of trees. What we have is a situation in which trees are being killed in an ad hoc manner, with some already dying and some already dead, due to the fact that no proper forward planning has been done for ground preparation, use of organic materials, soil, manure, and of course, irrigation, all important components for a successful life of a tree. If you look at some of the trees planted in the Deer Boulevard and in the Alameda estate, they are already in a stressful condition. Clearly, the minister must complicate environmental filter has not worked against and remains useless. What we also need, and one would have expected the current minister to lead on this subject, is a landscaping management plan. In order to sign and implement proper procedures when planting new trees and safeguarding existing ones by the voter. And as an aside, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister for Environment is also keen to repeat the statement that this is the new government leading by example. However, once again, we notice that the Minister's third budget speech, he continues to reach his speak from single-sided paper to paper. This, when we have a situation that in the Minister's first budget address, he informed Parliament of how the new green filter for procurement has established a policy of purchasing printers to print several sizes tests on all government departments, something that was pointed to the Minister by my own one learning from Mr. Figueroa for reading his speech from single sided paper. Mr. Speaker, moving to public matters. I think that it's happened that the only member of the gang that we're going to make this to see that. The Honourable, I think we need to calm down, I think I'm getting too nervous. The Honourable Minister for Environment is keen to be seen as someone who is passionate in the conservation of the public property, given the picture in his future account. Yes, as the Minister for Environment is enacting to protect them will mean that the indigenous public property of Gibraltar is critically endangered and on its way to face the same outcome as the Dodo in Mauritius. Much, of course, blame the GOP, always blame the GOP. Much the minister would like to blame the GOP government for all of the voters here. The fact remains that under his watch, we have arrived at a situation where the numbers of indigenous public property is the lowest ever. Not only that, knowing as he knows better than anyone in this chamber what the natural predators of the practices are, he's done nothing to deal with this serious problem. The minister seems to be caught like a rabbit on a rope by the headlights of an incoming car. With ensuring the population of seagulls do not continue to use the edge or take the practices as stated by me in my earlier speech, or the federal parts that pose such a threat to passages. Given that the current party in government can be termed as a party of all things to all men, it is clear that the minister has taken the decision of not telling federal parts for any possible loss of those that from those that would be against such policy. So through this indecision, we face extermination of indigenous barbary passages. For over a year now, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Minister has been trying to walk off his inaction in the passages on the basis of passages of the same genetic lineage will be brought from Morocco. Yet from the answer given both last month and in this one, we can conclude that on this issue of faith having the particles, as in the calling of Macau, or the calling of Google, or fellow class, the minister involves talk and more talk and no action. The speaker, moving to transparency and accountability. Lack of transparency are found from the manner in which this government operates. Take for instance the various companies providing a service to the Department of Environment. Back in mid-2013, I asked the owner maker who could provide me with copies of the contract provided services to the department, something he refused to do on the basis of such contracts in Maine exactly as they were when they came into government. However, in answer to a supplementary question from my owner and learner from the legal institution, the minister would not accept informing me of any variation of any of the existing contracts providing services to the Department of Environment because it would have to be a collegiate response from the government after we have informed the opposition. Yet, in May this year, once again, I asked the Honourable Minister if there had been any change to existing contracts, only to be responded in a total term that his role is not for working observance to the contract. Yet today, the opposition is aware of at least one variation to one contract in Wildlife Devotee Limited, in which, until very recently, the Honourable Minister had shares in that company and has now sold them to someone else. A contract, as it has, that has been awarded for maintenance of the Commonwealth Park. However, the changes to the ownership of Wildlife Devotee Limited were only found by the opposition as a result of my question to the Minister of Agriculture. Even the Minister had to tell us that only last week that he had just written to the Clerk of Parliament notifying him of the changes in the ownership and position of the country, on which the Honourable Minister had an interest before and his wife continues to be a shareholder. No one is saying that there is anything improper, but to say we're not entitled to quiz the government on this is nonsense. Moving on to health and safety. To talk about health and safety with regard to the initiative or actions by the current minister for health and safety is simply to say that nothing has happened or likely to happen while the current incumbent is holding such responsibility. In 19 years of listening to party speeches in this chamber, last year was the first time ever that a minister holding a responsibility for a particular project did not utter a single word on the responsibility the minister holds. Quite a dereliction of duty and an attitude of not willing to promote and develop health and safety policies which is the duty of the minister. Since last year's budget report, I have asked the Honourable Mr. Wasson whether government has conducted any review on the health and safety inspection team, the current legislation, its policies and procedures since December 2011. Insofar as it applies to the private sector and government organizations, and if so, to provide Parliament with a date of the review, the name of the person or entity, and details of the item examined and any implementation emanating from the past review. Only to be answered by the Minister by saying, no, Mr. Speaker. The answer, Mr. Speaker, is quite incredible as it seems to imply that the Minister for Health and Safety is not aware that a review is indeed taking place behind the minister's back, without him not knowing anything about it. The review is being conducted between the chief minister and the union, not to mention the very report submitted by very specialists on health and safety on how to review the current legislation and the inspector's role within the factory act. But Mr. Speaker, the minister's response is symptomatic of the malaise that prevails with this government attitude towards health and safety. Consider my question to the minister in relation to how many cultural factors have been issued, or how many health and safety committees have now emerged within the public sector, and one to provide is remarkably in bottleneck style, quote, there have been no new cultural factors and there are no new health and safety committees, unquote. In other words, not only the minister is not prepared to do anything to develop health and safety, but he's quite proud of the fact that he does not care about the responsibilities he has. Given the circumstances that prevail, it is quite understandable that the chief minister is doing the review on health and safety, but he is forgiven for saying that in normal circumstances, when a minister refuses to do his responsibility, the normal thing to do is to get rid of the minister. and place someone who is willing and capable of discharging his responsibility. Yet we only have the clear situation of a chief minister keep praying around the minister's dereliction of duty in order not to upset the minister by his dereliction. What this says is a weak chief minister with an attractive government. As with all these words of the mouth, the recurring issue of our patronage has also had a role to play with regard to the manner different ministers operate a negative policy on health and safety. Taking into consideration the response of the education minister when he refused to provide Parliament with copies of the health and safety audit report in some schools, or the response of the health minister, which also refuses to provide Parliament with copies of the health and safety report by the Health Authority and Health and Safety Committee, or the fact that the government will not provide Parliament with the name of the company that infringes the law in health and safety as is the practice in the UK. Or the fact that this government is not willing to provide annual reports on health and safety for the benefit of consumers, employers, health and safety specialists, and parliament, in order to assess either the government's lack of aims and objectives or statistical facts emanating from the various industry groups involved. It is a scandal that goes to the heart of how this government dishonestly operates. It is obvious, Mr. Speaker, that if we are going to have progress in health and safety, or environment, or in a safer new power station, or in not managing our children's livelihoods with debt arising from uncontrolled and unaccountable spending from this government, then the sooner we have achieved the government, the better for this community. If we, as a community, want to restore, if we want to restore the sense of security and prosperity we enjoy under a previous with the government, then the sooner we elect the unity of the government, the better. And if we want to restore the sense of normalization that existed between the communities on both sides of the frontier, the sooner we elect the unity of the government, the better. To conclude, Mr. Speaker, from the offices and benches, there is only one word left to say, and that is Palante. Finally, my thanks to the staff of Parliament for their continued help and advice.
The Honourable Mr. Manson, Sacramento.
Mr. Speaker, we have now been in office over 2.5 years, and I can reflect proudly on the differences that have been undertaken by my ministry and the department I am responsible for. This year has been an extremely positive one in terms of numerous developments coming to fruition, as well as how our services have been extended to assist the more vulnerable in our community. We are now at a stage where progress is real and is tangible. And Mr. Speaker, there are still more good things to come, as other projects become a reality during the course of this coming year. I will commend to the progress in my policy portfolio, as this has been so marked this year and symbolic of this government's overall commitment to a fair and just society. As I have said previously, equality is at the heart of this government, and our commitment to equality shows a natural progression towards an inclusive society, and it is a recognition of a modern Gibraltar. We are committed to setting up an Equal Opportunities Commission, which will be responsible for promoting the treatment for all without discrimination as provided for in the Equal Opportunities Act. This coming financial year will see an advancement in developing this, and in the meantime, the statutory function will continue to be discharged by the Citizen Advice Bureau, and we continue to work closely with them and support their initiatives. I am immensely proud of having been appointed by the Chief Minister as the First Minister for Equality, and in that capacity, having signed the Civil Partnership Act earlier this year. It truly is a landmark piece of legislation, Mr. Speaker, one which enables the formal recognition of relationships between couples of the same sex. It is important because this government recognizes that there are gay men and gay women in Gibraltar, and they live in loving and committed relationships. They are entitled to a formal recognition of that commitment in the eyes of the law, and that, Mr. Speaker, is progress, and that is equality. To have been invited to the first civil partnership ceremony was truly special, and particularly since it was a celebration by a couple who have been pioneers in standing up for gay rights and challenging the establishment. They won their David and Goliath battle against the former administration, who refused to give them the right to a joint tenancy in a government flat. And that case was fought all the way to the Privy Council at taxpayers' expense. All kinds of things, Mr. Speaker. Our government recognizes the fundamental human rights of gay people, quite unlike the way that they were treated when the GSD rolled out. Furthermore, Mr. Speaker, this past year we have outlawed homophobic hate crime and hate speech and made these aggravated criminal offenses. It is therefore no surprise that community groups now feel the freedom and confidence to organize days such as International Day Against Homophobia and Pride. Such groups no longer live in fear of expressing themselves, and they know that they have the full support of this government in these endeavors. Turning to disability, it is clear that Gibraltar's landscape is changing to make it more accessible. And our progress is not limited to raising physical limitations, but also raising learning disabilities. Our aim is to improve the lives of people with disabilities, and this has been achieved by having, for the first time in Gibraltar history, a Ministry for Equality, and within that, establish a department that is dedicated to disabilities. Since last year, we now have a different staff. We have a head of department to deal with matters at the strategic and policy level, and a truly dedicated and motivated disability awareness officer. And I have to say at this point, Mr. Speaker, that does not represent an increase in government in our confidence, but more readjustment of existing posts. Equality is an issue that concerns all government departments, and indeed it does our community. And my department is able to coordinate and oversee matters relating to disability in all other government departments and is involved in all government projects. It is the policy of this government to ensure that all new projects going forward are fully accessible, and my department offers advice and guidance on. We have undertaken a robust review of all matters to do with disabilities, and in the past year have made significant developments in an area that has generally been quite dormant. As we work on achieving a disability outcome plan, all these things will need to interline. Mr. Speaker, the fruits of our work, and in particular inter-agency working together, have not gone unnoticed, and recently we were recognized by a tour operator specializing in holidays to meet the requirements of people with disabilities as an accessible holiday destination. An achievement indeed for our initiative and that of the Minister for Tourism to be recognized internationally. One of the most significant aspects of the work we have taken so far is to review current legislation and provide broad models on the UN Convention on the Rights of the Disabled. A lot of work has been undertaken on the drafting of this important piece of legislation, and I am delighted to report that we will be in a position to present the new law by the end of this year. The most fundamental change that the new legislation will bring is a statutory obligation to make premises accessible to people with disabilities. At the moment, we are giving careful consideration to how this will be achieved in a responsible manner via learning from the experience in the UK. And notwithstanding any advance of the legislation being in place, we already have a programme of auditing and reforming government premises in public areas, and of course, all new government projects will be fully accessible. The Government Technical Services Department, in consultation with the Ministry for Equality and the GSA Occupational Therapy Department, have already been busy identifying and making improvements to our community. Mr. Speaker, I am sure you have noticed all the progress and significant improvements we have already made. And in order to ensure that we are fully equipped to do this properly, my department arranged for specialist training to be delivered on access audits earlier this year. The first trained participants to be able to identify barriers and to access and solve these, including access audits to historical buildings. The course is aimed at the Government Technical Services Department, Occupational Services, and anyone involved with the responsibility of access to public buildings and services. The Accessible Beaches Project is a prime example of the huge progress we have made. This year, we took stock of the flagship project we undertook at the beaches last year, and the service has been expanded and further improved by the Gibraltar Tourist Board. An announcement of the new bathing pavilion at the old Gaffer site will be made very shortly, and the whole community will be able to fully benefit from it this summer. I say fully because this exciting new project is completely accessible throughout. Works have been undertaken to bring Michael's Cave, the Gibraltar International Airport Terminal, and Parliament will be fully accessible for wheelchair users once the refurbishment works are complete. Works have also been undertaken at St Bernard's Hospital. We have worked with a Gibraltar bus company making all bus stops accessible to wheelchair users, as the ones we inherited were not. And the new bus purchase will be fully accessible too. Voice synthesizers will be installed in all listing government rental estates in order to assist those with visual impairment, and these will be ready shortly. We have been working closely with VITA on issues relating to our deaf community, and government has funded staff from the care agency, the DHA, and the Department of Education to undertake British sign language training in levels 1 and 2, and we supported the first deaf awareness conference in October last year. We have been working to ensure that there are no barriers in the organised public events. We will have seen a British Sign Language interpreter in place during the National Day Rally over the past 2 years, and we have already been engaged for this year. At present, we are working on a test relay service so as to make services more accessible to the deaf. Government has now purchased a wheelchair viewing platform, and this will be used at all public gatherings and concerts, whether or not organised by government, to enable participation by wheelchair users. And I will expand further on services related to people with learning disabilities when I refer to the care agency. We have invested greatly in the fabric of Gibraltar already as part of this government's task of achieving access for all and enabling the disabled in our community. And I feel that we have a long way in dealing with issues related to disabilities. And I am not suggesting that everything that needs to be done has been done, but a lot has been done so far. And certainly, this is a work in progress, and we can be proud of our achievements so far. We continue to work closely with related groups and societies, and this is one of the benefits of the government's open door policy. Interdepartmental working is proving to be very effective, and the success of the non-centralized department is obvious. Turning to women, Mr. Speaker, I always wonder whether there is such a thing as women's issues, as any issue that affects women affects us all. So what does equality for women really mean? It means identifying circumstances in which women are particularly vulnerable or face at a disadvantage. It is about ensuring a level playing field and opportunities, and what it does not mean is that women should be favoured over men, whether it is for jobs or posts or for places on board. I have mentioned in the past that government is in the process of collecting and collating statistics of women in the workplace. Once that data is ready, we will evaluate the situation and decide what action needs to be taken, and we will consider what initiatives may need to be introduced. The recent change to the public sector working hours will undoubtedly benefit many working women, and the flexibility of the working hours will help them balance home and work commitment. We are also looking at projects to empower girls and young women, and we have an excellent education system to speak in Gibraltar. And I want to ensure that young women have the confidence to pursue whatever path they wish to pursue in life. Furthermore, in the context of women's issues, last year, government formally requested the extension to Gibraltar of the Convention of the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Such a step forms part of the government's continuing policy on the principles of equality and fairness. Mr. Speaker, I am fortunate to represent the Gibraltar Parliament on a steering committee of Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians. Through this forum, I hold regular meetings with like-minded colleagues and have been invited to speak at conferences that I have attended. Mr. Speaker, I would like to announce today that as a member of the Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians steering group, I have agreed to host a conference for women parliamentarians in early 2015. Personally, I am very excited about this, and it will be the first time that there will have been a conference dedicated to meaningful discussion on the advancement of women's issues in Gibraltar. We know that another issue that affects women, predominantly, though not exclusively, is domestic abuse. Apart from the provision of 2 buildings to be used as shelter for women, the previous administration did very little in terms of support for victims of domestic abuse. Women in Need, the charity that runs the shelter, had very little practical input and support from government aside from a grant. And Mr. Speaker, joined up We are in the process of regularizing their position in connection to government, but more importantly, working closely with them to offer real and practical support and offer them training and guidance. The staff at Women in Need undertake exemplary work to help victims of domestic abuse, and the service is an essential component of the whole domestic abuse matrix. Importantly, there is no communication between them and social services so that they can work together seamlessly in relevant cases. Social services is a pivotal player in this, and I will expand on the changes made to the service to make it more effective later on. At present, we are involved in the process of collecting empirical data to analyze the extent and impact of domestic abuse intervention. We are also working on establishing a forum where all the key players in relation to domestic abuse will meet and discuss working practices at a strategic level. And as soon as the work necessary in the individual department is complete, we will meet together to develop a strategy. And that's not to say, Mr. Speaker, that because the forum has not formally met, that no work has been done at a strategic level or individually in developing this department. And finally, on this front, through my contact with other Commonwealth parliamentarians, we will be twinning with colleagues in Wales who have developed a very successful domestic abuse strategy. Turning to the care agency, Mr. Speaker, I continue to try and improve the way in which the care agency develops and delivers a more efficient and effective service than that which I found when I took on ministerial responsibility for it. Like any progressive organization, there is now a continuous process of revision that takes place as we encounter daily issues. As an organization that was in complete chaos when I inherited it, it is now beginning to take shape. And one of the major problems was that the Human Resources Department operated in a way that was completely ad hoc and uncoordinated. Last year, we introduced a database for human resources, which is now fully functional, and with improvements being made continuously, we are now investing in the Human Resources Department so that staff have a clear understanding of employment issues within the agency. Although the care agency is the fruit of the merger of the Swedish Social Services and Elderly Care Agencies, aspects of the agency had never merged, particularly in the way that the Human Resources Department operated. A case in point is the staff handbook, and this year we see the consolidation of both previous handbooks and the creation of one single handbook. In terms of investment and management, Mr. Speaker, in December 2013, 12 junior and middle managers embarked on a 5-day course in management, and management training spread over 3 months, allowing time to complete specific tasks of managing people, communicating effectively, and building effective teams. Employees are the backbone to every organization and its service users, and the people that we need to ensure receive the best possible training. Therefore, the development and implementation of an effective framework for learning in all forms, academic, professional, and vocational, is imperative to enable staff to be fully prepared and provide the appropriate care to the people we are responsible for. With stronger training, support staff are now able to feel professional in their roles and have a clear understanding as well as knowing the purpose for which their job is being delivered. It is very satisfying to see that there are still a vast majority of workers who show vocational qualities that can be enhanced with appropriate training. The care agency continues with its approach of investing in people and will continue to strive towards ensuring that its workforce comprises appropriately skilled people in the right places, working to deliver high-quality training. The care agency's new dedicated training team is exemplary and provides a better service year on year. During this year, the care agency training team has been extremely busy and proactive. They have not only continued to research, facilitate, deliver, and review training to ensure evidence-based practices taught to enhance skills, but they continue to develop their own skills and develop in-house training programs. They have also expanded their remit by collaborating and delivering training for other government departments. The elements of the training are split into numerous sections. I will obviously not refer to all the training that we undertake, Mr. Speaker, but I will concentrate on the most important ones. Principally, Mr. Speaker, the introduction to the care agency will involve the care agency generic core training, and this has continued to be provided throughout 2013 and 2014. for existing staff and ETCL families. I want to mention a new resistive piece of equipment that we have bought, which is an age simulation and empathy suit, and it's been incorporated into the training. This equipment helps staff to walk in the shoes of the elderly and thereby make even more in tune with the needs of their day. Trainers and instructors in the care agency have been trained, qualified, and updated in various subjects to enable management training programs to be continued and developed in health in the individual services. And it is important that the care agency training team also maintain their professional development and enhance their skills, and therefore, provisioning was made for them to gain further qualifications as recognized individuals and the youth care by completing level 3, the level 3 award in preparing to teach in the lifelong learning sector. In November 2013, the care agency training team procured the British Institute of Learning Disabilities to visit Gibraltar and provide training on learning disability awareness. This training consisted of 5 one-day sessions, and over the period of the 5 days, a total of 127 people attended from the Care Agency, Department of Education, Royal Gibraltar Police, Gibraltar Health Authority, and the Gibraltar Sports and Leisure Authority. The aim of the training was to develop an understanding and make a positive approach to working with people with learning disabilities, autism, and mental health problems. The training had excellent reviews, and such training was expanded upon the future. And not only have the dedicated in-house training team provided a service to the care agency, they have also shared their expertise and trained other government departments and bodies. Our team has provided training to the lifeguards employed by the Tourist Board in moving and manual handling procedures so that they are fully equipped to assist people with disabilities to use the beach accessibility service. Relationships between the care agency and the Gibraltar Health Authority are thriving. The School of Health Studies has made places available for nurses working in elderly residential services to attend courses in mentorship, for prevention, dignity awareness, diabetes, and diabetes to name a few. And the courses allow staff to maintain continued professional development with the Kingston University in the UK. Moreover, two care agency employees have been given the opportunity to undertake the enrolled nurse course to complete this coming month, and they will then return to the elderly residential services with qualification knowledge and skills that they can put into practice as nurses. And it is expected that this opportunity will be repeated regularly every couple of years, and thereby increasing the local availability of people with the skills and qualifications required for such job vacancies when they arrive. And perhaps the most significant initiative that was commenced last year is a training program that has been devised and is coordinated and delivered by care agency staff through the Ministry of Employment. In December 2013, the care agency developed a course, An Introduction to Elderly and Dementia Care, and has facilitated the delivery of this course to just over 100 registered unemployed people with the Employment and Training Board through this financial year. This course, Mr. Speaker, has been incredibly, incredibly successful. These people receive fundamental theoretical information and are taught practical skills over a 3-week period, attending 4 or 5 days a week. All the subjects follow the Skills for Care Common Induction Standards for Care Workers in the UK, and on completion of the course, attendees are provided with certificates of attendance. In addition, a 2-week work experience placement is offered in elderly residential services of the care agency or belongs to the ward at St. Bernard Hospital. And the training will enable these people to build up a portfolio to support them in their application for employment in the care sector in the future, if they decide that this is their chosen profession. As you know, Mr. Speaker, it is anticipated that the care agency will continue to deliver this course for up to a further 100 people in the coming year. And as you will be aware, government will be operating 2 new elderly residential facilities by the end of the year. In order to operate these services, we will need staff. And we are therefore preempting the need for staff by commencing to offer training in this field as well as hands-on work experience. And this will avoid having to do what the GSD had to do, where they had to import labour in the care sector because of apparent lack of skill in our workforce. So unlike the GSD when they were in office, we are talking this issue head on, and we are coordinating our approach. Both meet Mr. Speaker and us, while residents were never considered for employment in the care sector, was that locals did not want to carry out this type of work. That statistic still, Mr. Speaker, is far from the case. And judging from the number of residents who have already been either undertaking training or offered or taken up employment in this field, both by the care agency and private contractors. Mr. Speaker, this is about giving the people the tools and the opportunity to carry out the job. Incidentally, a lot of the people who have undergone the training have already secured employment in the care sector. A continued investment in devoted care and in devoted employment, Mr. Speaker. Furthermore, the care agency continues to offer ETCL and BRAD trainees the opportunity to have on-the-job training and experience, giving them the potential to apply for a vacancy within the care agency, after gaining the necessary skills to undertake the work, Mr. Speaker. And since this initiative commenced, we have already employed in the care agency 63 people who started their placement in the care agency, either through ETCL or the grad scheme. Another success story, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I return to the different services of the care agency. Starting with elderly residential services, and one of the major achievements this year has been the fruition of negotiations with the Metro Union in relation to the nursing and nursing allied professionals who work in elderly residential services of the care agency, essentially what used to be the elderly care agency prior to the merger in 2009. Care agency staff working in the sector were transferred to the DHA effective from the 1st of November 2013 and now enjoy parity with their DHA counterparts on the basis of equal pay for equal work. Staff are deployed to the care agency under the management of the elderly residential services. In this process, the new agreement of agenda for change has been applied to all elderly care nursing staff. And this claim was ongoing for over 4 years, ignored by the previous administration. And I must take the opportunity to thank all from the care agency and UNITE who form part of the working group, the care agency and GHA management who enabled the smooth transition of the process, and particularly the care agency finance team who calculated the payment of arrears in record time. The new regime has had a positive impact on the working conditions of this collective. Subsequently, the restructure of the nursing workforce supposed an increment of the hours of care provided for the elderly. And it must be noted that since these new working shifts, post the commencement of the new working arrangements, there has been a significant decrease in the need for overtime, if at all. So while there has been an increase in expenditure due to the increase in salaries, there have also been very significant savings. Yearly updates on mandatory training for nursing staff are being carried out as part of their continued development. Collaboration with GHA professionals has been maintained since last year, providing in-house training in many different areas of nursing for elderly care staff. In addition to that, accredited modules run through the School of Health Studies and have been available for elderly care nursing staff. And furthermore, in conjunction with the School of Health Studies, a GHA-led and a GHA-librarian, there is a project to open a nursing library in Mount Alvernia in order to improve the resources available for the nursing collective of elderly care. Child nurses and team leaders have attended a leadership and management course, something which has never been done before in this service, Mr. Speaker. There has been a campaign of awareness and safeguarding at risk organized by professionals from the DHA and in collaboration with the Safeguarding Addicts Committee. A further basic awareness course on safeguarding addicts is ongoing at present for frontline professionals of social organizations. A rotation of charge nurses on night duty has been implemented, providing a support and supervision framework of the night duties of the nursing staff. Satellite services such as John Cochrane Road and Gallagher Ward and the Joy Home now receive nightly visits to the charge nurse, something that has never occurred before. And the premises was run by the staff at night with no support of nursing management. All policies are under review, Mr. Speaker, with the aim of updating all procedures throughout the elderly residential service. As from March 2014, a speaking language therapist has been allocated to elderly services. This is an achievement, as in the past, the residents requiring assessment had to wait for weeks, even months, before they were assessed by these professionals. In our service, Mr. Speaker, we do not only care for the residents, we also care for their relatives, and we have arranged for two informative sessions for relatives of people suffering from dementia to be organized at Mount Alvernia, with the support of the DHHS professionals. It has been an innovative, successful, and welcomed initiative, and will continue during this year on a regular basis. Finally, I cannot talk about Mount Alvernia without referring to a chronic structure that has been in place for 10 years. I am, of course, referring to the company, which was initially erected to repair those balconies 10 years ago, but has been in place so long, Mr. Speaker, that the scaffolding itself is dilapidated and requires replacement, and it's the deterioration of the balconies as such that the scaffolding is now supporting the balconies. But I'm delighted to announce that the balconies are finally being renovated and the works will be ready by the end of this month. And once complete, not only will this enhance the facade of the building, but also the quality of life of the residents who will be able to gain access to them after so many years and be able to enjoy the spectacular views which have been blocked from them up to now because of this accident. The retaining wall in the east side of Mount Alvernia will also be repaired after years of requests and being ignored. Our elderly care facilities are being expanded, and this will enhance the care that can be provided in the future. The RNS residential facility for people with dementia will be ready by the end of the year, and we have already opened a new facility at the John McIntosh Home, albeit partially at the moment. At present, it provides support for residents of the Jewish home on a temporary basis while the facility is being refurbished, and in addition, there are 10 long-term patients in the DHA. The service is under constant review, of course, and to ensure that all provision and requirements for the welfare and safety of its occupants are met. A complete new approach to the concept of the building was required after the fiasco and waste of money incurred by the previous government, causing delay to the work and therefore to its opening. Professionals from both the DHA have worked and elderly care services have worked together to make this project viable, safe, and secure for service users. Once the Jewish home residents are relocated to the refurbished Jewish home, there will be a total of 54 residential beds available to the elderly. The much-needed refurbishment of the Jewish home is now forthcoming. The building requires a full refurbishment due to the solid state that it presents and inherited from the lack of action from the previous administration. Because it happens to buildings if the people, when they're not maintained and they're not kept up, they just dilapidate, and then repairs become more expensive. But at least, Mr. Speaker, we are getting on with it. And the Jewish community will, of course, have an input in the design and works to be carried out to the building to ensure that their requirements are met. And before I turn to the other services of the care agency, I must give credit to the nursing coordinator and her team who have been at the forefront of the transition process and have made the opening of the new facility at John McIntosh Room possible. Family Social Services, Mr. Speaker, as you may know, this is comprised of 14 children and families, adults, child rehabilitation, probation, and disability. I can now state with pride, Mr. Speaker, that for the first time ever in the history of social services, the complement of social workers will be fully filled by September this year. Bearing in mind that a complement of social workers is now higher than it has ever been. We have entered into an agreement with a recruitment agency in the UK, which has enabled a faster response in the recruitment process. The days when it took an extraordinary length of time to recruit are now over. Let me add that in the interim, and while vacancies are being filled substantively, we have engaged supply cover until the recruitment is achieved so that the service is not affected and does not suffer. We have also, in this financial year, added 4 new posts to enable newly qualified social workers to come into the service. This new post will provide that they be supervised in a program of training, supervision that will equip them to apply for jobs as social workers as soon as they have required the necessary experience. The professional development continues with increased training for social workers. authority for this year has been investment in holistic procedures that will incorporate all authorities involved in social care. These procedures will be produced for free of the services, children, families, adults, and the residential service. The procedures will ensure the safeguarding of our vulnerable people in a coordinated manner that all agencies can follow. It is envisioned that this project will be completed by the end of the financial year, and it will depend on how the consolidation of all existing procedures and adaptation to legal advancements is effected. And I want to emphasize, Mr. Speaker, that a lot of the advancements and positive developments that we have now achieved in social services is a result of working on an interagency basis, and we have now been able to formalize good working relationships with the health authority, the Department of Education, and in particular the Royal Gibraltar Police and their safeguarding units. And the benefits of this are very, very apparent, Mr. Speaker. Let me, Mr. Speaker, now explain the different roles and what we are achieving within each of the services. The Children and Families team is comprised of a number of different services provided to children and their families when in need. And the main ethos of the service work is that children thrive on loved and cared for, and generally this is within a family unit. Early intervention is essential so as to ensure that children do not need placement outside their home. And although safeguarding and child protection is usually reflected in the public arena, it is the work that is now invested into the early stages that ensures that families move on from crises and resolve their difficulties. Because, Mr. Speaker, we are now changing our strategy in terms of child protection and focusing our resources and emphasizing on preventing crises from happening. Because early intervention avoids family breakdown and criminality, domestic abuse, and substance misuse, among other things. And that is why we are investing in this process. Allowing for this approach will prevent further pressure on a range of services such as care, health, and education. And in keeping with our early intervention strategy, we have introduced an additional service, the Parent and Child Parenting Assessment Program. And this serves both as an assessment and as a program whereby the parent can acquire the necessary skills to be able to care for their child at a good enough level, and in some cases, avoid the child entering the care system altogether. Mr. Speaker, part of the restructure of social services following our review, we have introduced a duty team, and this is a first point of contact for referrals. This year, we have seen a growth phase of a social work manager in this team. This has enabled the development of databases to gather information for experts to highlight the trends in society and where the need lies. A new initiative this year has been the development of a protocol and a database for domestic abuse, and this has highlighted families where this is a common occurrence and intervention is required. However, it has also helped to identify families where the difficulty has begun to arise and supportive efforts for couples and men to resolve their issues without this impacting on their children. And as part of the development of the agency's domestic abuse strategy, a new initiative, Mr. Speaker, something that never occurred to DSU when they were in office, two social workers and the agency's psychologists will attend a training program so as to deliver workshops with victims of domestic violence. They will also deliver the work of the perpetrators of domestic abuse. It is no longer good enough to safeguard and protect victims and their children, and we have recognized that the perpetrators continue to act out the behavior that they have learned, and punishment in itself is not the only solution. These perpetrators will continue to act on their behaviors and continue to be parents, and they must be assisted in making the necessary changes and breaking the cycle. We have our long-term team as we change the focus from reactive to preventative, and we are developing what we do in the long-term team. We are also in the process of a complete review of the fostering and adoption service, and there is now a dedicated adoption and fostering social worker. This service is now offering support to pre-adoption placements, pre-adoptive parents, and foster carers. Support provided is in terms of one-to-one informal training and supervision will be offered shortly as part of development within the service. Furthermore, people set on the adoption and fostering panel will receive training at the end of this year so that they can meet the competences required to perform their duties. The Fort Worcester team continues to provide support from children directly relating to their parent separation, and the parenting program is currently under review by Taylor Swift, meeting the needs changes in terms of parenting as a need of our society changes. We have introduced a new service, and this is a respite service for children with disabilities following an assessment. This is offered by their care packages in the community or a necessary residential center. A working party has been established in order to carry out a review of the service of the residential services, and this review will provide information on two critical issues. The principal issue is that of how we are caring for children and whether the model being used is the better option. This review will also look at the issues existing in the management structure. A working party has been formed for this purpose and will be looking at all aspects and issues relating to children with challenging behaviour as well. The Adult Services Department of Social Services has been able to focus on services on the most vulnerable adults in our community through the 1-point referral system, which was introduced in the community office. Management of the 1-point entry system into urgent care to include domiciliary care, day centres and residential care has proved to be extremely successful and has provided care needed to the most vulnerable clients in our community when they are in need of support without the creation of endless waiting lists. There is now a needs-led criteria when considering who is most in need of the service. From the 1st of April to the 31st of March, the ABBA team received a total of 540 referrals from people ranging from professionals in different agencies to neighbours and concerned people in the community. Referrals have increased by 119 from the previous year alone, and this number is increasing on a monthly basis as our community realises services offered by social services are no longer stagnant but available to everyone who really needs them. And I am pleased to say that the new systems implemented continue to ensure that all services are allocated in a fair and equitable way based on each person's individual health and social care support needs. The services being provided for the elderly in our community continue to be developed and increased at a significant and dramatic rate. This year, there have been a total of 53 admissions to Mount Alvernia, Cochrane Ward and Calgary. Of these, 22 were people in the community that were at high risk and required admission to avoid serious incident or hospitalisation, and 31 were admitted from hospital after being deemed to be long-stay patients, unable to return home as a required 24-hour term. The change introduced by us as the speaker to the admission criteria has resulted in the most needy people being admitted first, regardless of their time on the waiting list. Domiciliary care services continue to be provided by two providers, and an additional 125 people have been granted domiciliary care this year. This means that by the end of the financial year, we are providing domiciliary care to 229 people, more than trebling, the number of people who were provided with a service since we came into office, because at that point only 75 people were receiving the service. Additionally, 51 people already in receipt of domiciliary care were granted further hours, and I am proud to say that we are providing more domiciliary care than ever, so many vulnerable people are benefiting from this initiative. The newly introduced reviewing service of domiciliary care is working well. The new reviewing officer also carries out quality assurance roles, which helps the agency keep check in the private providers, ensuring the clients receive the best possible services. The agency is now working seamlessly with colleagues in the GSA. Out of the new domiciliary care recipients, 74 people were awarded care packages in order to expedite discharge from hospital and their recovery and integration in the community. This, together with increased admissions into Mount Alvernia, has reduced the amount of long-stay patients in hospitals, which before would have blocked hospital beds as people would have been unable to survive in the community without support. Social workers now attend hospital messages during team meetings on a weekly basis and support the discharge planning process by assessing patient needs and putting packages of care in place that will meet the patient's need to prevent future admissions into hospital. And this is speaker. I am very proud to say that the new day centre, which we promised when I first came in office, is now fully operational and is providing a service to so many elderly people in the community. This purposeful stay centre is certainly one of the jewels in the crown of the care agency. It provides therapeutic and welcoming environment for the elderly who otherwise would be isolated in the community. It provides a service that also monitors their needs on a weekly basis and becomes a point of quick referral to social workers if their circumstances change and they require more support. Five social workers from the adult team have been trained in investigating officer and safeguarding manager roles within the safeguarding advocate risk procedures. Social workers have had patients in the UK and hospital discharge and assessments of care packages in the community. Social workers have trained in conjunction with the Royal Gibraltar Police in order to become designated risk managers of sexual offenders in Gibraltar and be part of the Gibraltar Public Protection Arrangement and support other departments in the management of high-risk offenders. And here is where a social services social relationship with the police is particularly important for this season. Social services adult team now have 137 clients receiving a quick response service. They are being contacted on a monthly basis by the elderly needs coordinator and are being monitored for phone calls and police visits. This ensures that the most vulnerable in our community are not at risk. And this is another fantastic new initiative that we have introduced this week. Turning to the disability service. This service has greatly improved. I said so last year and it's been well, and we have improved again this year. We have worked on the objectives set down in our business plan last year with the aim of carrying out greater improvements and to develop the standard and quality of care at the Dr. Hidalgo Home and at the St. Benedict Research Centre. Once again, we have embarked on a robust training program to further develop employees professionally and extensive in-house and external training courses undertaken during this year. For example, we have, during the period of April to March 2012-2013, training was undertaken by 161 members of staff, and a total of 286 hours of training provided. But this year, training was attended by 497 members of staff, and it amounted to 624 hours. This represents a total increase of training by 300%, Mr. Speaker. And that is year to year in our administration, Mr. Speaker. If we were to compare it to the little or no training provided before 2011, the Speaker, the statistics, that is the comparative statistics of this problem. All medication, environmental, and documentation audits have been reviewed, and these are now carried out on a monthly basis, so as to flag up any issues that may arise and they can be addressed quickly. And I am pleased to inform that the outcome of the last environmental agency visit at the Dr. Hidalgo Home in February was that everything was found to be in good order, to the extent that for the first time ever, there was no submission of any advice or comments for improvement. Our liaison strategy with the various government departments is now established and is producing very positive results, particularly in the professional relationships with the CSO and the Royal Gibraltar Police. In fact, we have provided training to the Royal Gibraltar Police on how to deal with people with learning disabilities. We continue to network with other government departments as well as with other different groups and societies, and this has created a strong and effective communication with the following societies. Additionally, parents and relatives are well informed of what is happening and have easy access to the service and to managers. By introducing monthly meetings with parents and relatives held at St. Benedict, families are kept informed and have an opportunity to provide feedback. The home has also been refurbished recently, Mr. Speaker, and we have also introduced a further flat to be able to increase the respite facilities that we can offer. We now have a structured program of activities in order to enrich the service users' social environment, and we encourage them to engage in meaningful activities in the community. They are undertaking numerous activities which are too long to list, but they include things like weekly drum sessions at bedside, attending supportive holidays of their choice, participating in various charity events. But importantly, Mr. Speaker, people from residents from Dr. Hidalgo and Service Leaders of St. Bernadette are now undertaking workplaces supported by staff. But this is a very, very important initiative which gives them confidence and respect to their days. And we in fact have two service users. So, Mr. Speaker, we have six service users who are currently in part-time employment. This year, Mr. Speaker, we have had an increase in admissions both to St. Bernadette Speaker Center and to Dr. Hidalgo, both to the residential service as well as the respite service. And we have therefore had to accommodate for these very needs. We have very importantly also developed a transitional policy for the transitional pathway for children with learning disabilities moving into the adult services. This has been done in conjunction with social services and the Department of Education. We have also spent the last year concentrating on developing policies for staff at Dr. Hidalgo and St. Bernadette so that everybody is clear on the framework within which they have to operate. So I'm particularly grateful to everyone who works in the disability service because of the huge improvements that they have achieved in the service during the year. Now turning to the finance department of social services and members of drug rehabilitation. And this past year has seen considerable investment in the physical fabric of British Farm Rehabilitation Centre. The facilities have already seen a significant transformation which has enhanced the safe and comfortable therapeutic environment we aim to create for people suffering from various forms of addiction, which will make it more conducive to their successful recovery. However, this by itself will be futile if we have not addressed the underlying causes which are preventing many people from accessing treatment. We have worked hard to simplify the onerous and archaic systems and processes that prospective applicants had to contend with in the past, cumbersome procedures that have never been given any thought by the previous administration. And now all agencies that link into drug treatment from social services work together to ensure that applications from anyone wishing to be admitted to the farm are dealt with expeditiously. And the results of the changes we have introduced speak for themselves. Since 2012, admissions to Digital Farm have increased year on year. In fact, in 2013, Digital Farm saw 49 admissions, the highest number in 10 years, Mr. Speaker, and over double the number of admissions in 2011. That is how badly the old Digital Farm, managed by the GOP administration, was failing people with addiction problems in our community. No, absolutely. I agree, Mr. Figueroa. Yes, I agree. Particularly in the field of social services, I have to say. I recently announced that we have re-established formal contact with Broadway Mall. This is Speaker, perhaps Mr. Ferreira might want to explain some scoring own goals, because if you invite me to comment on the GSP record, track record, and say to everyone, I'm happy to do so, but I would rather carry on with that. I recently announced that we have re-established formal contact with Broadway Mall, one of the longest established and respected rehabilitation centres in the UK. This has opened a new and exciting chapter in the transformation of Digital Farm. We are currently working on developing a partnership which will include staff training, consultancy and staff consultants. I have always advocated for the inclusion of the voluntary sector and its service users as important stakeholders in how the service develops. And since assuming office, my open door policy towards groups such as families, alcoholics, and narcotics anonymous has yielded very real and positive results. During our establishment, numerous members of these groups have given them their time to undertake voluntary work within Digital Farm, something that rarely happened in the past. In my maiden speech, Mr. Speaker, I referred to Digital Farm as being at the start and out of my own, and clearly, this is no longer the case. I would like to announce today a new initiative that we will be introducing at Digital Farm, and that will be a top-up admission service available to people who are in recovery, similar to a recent retreat. It will be offered to anyone who wishes to take it up, having undergone the 12-step program, and the aim of this is to provide continuous support and avoid relapse. In the past, I have referred to how we need to develop a community and outreach support for those who are unable to commit to the residential rehabilitation model for various reasons. And over the past year, we have firmly established such a service, which is operated by two counselors from Bruce's Fund, who operate the far away from the Gladys Center, and they provide an invaluable service, not only for those who complete treatment, but for those who suffer from the fallout of addiction, particularly their families. And one important and very significant development has been the addition of one further counselor who will be based within the community on a full-time basis. This additional post will also enable us to provide a service to the prison, where we will be able to roll out a comprehensive rehabilitation program for the first time ever. This has created additional rehabilitation routes to complement the work undertaken at Bruce's Fund and will make decisive inroads in addressing the well-documented link between drugs and crime, which I referred to in the last section. At the Drugs Awareness Fund, we have continued to work closely with statutory and official bodies, including law enforcement and various sporting associations. There are many events that are being sponsored where the anti-drugs message has literally reached thousands of children. This includes the Mini Olympics in partnership with the Royal Devoted Police, as well as other events throughout the past year, such as football, basketball, and volleyball tournaments. The public will also become familiar with our high-profile campaigns that we have conducted with the Royal Devoted Police to address issues of concern, such as teen drinking, and at peak periods, such as National Day and Christmas. Our ongoing drug awareness workshops in all education establishments from middle school onwards have continued over the past year, and the care agency has worked in close partnership with a very dedicated team at the Royal Devoted Police and recovering addicts to great effect and to ensure that the best possible outcomes for young people who may be exposed to the risk of drugs. At a strategic level, members of the Drug Strategy Working Group formed last year and led by myself to continue to work together. We have attended key conferences in Strasbourg and Brussels at EU level, where we have established valuable contacts with leading figures in various areas that will inform how we will develop our strategic responses to the challenges faced to drugs during our community. So far, Mr. Speaker, this year, our priority has been in getting our facilities and the services that we deliver right, so that we can now progress to working on these matters at a more strategic level. Finally, on the point of drugs, I would also like to announce that the care agency will be introducing a substance abuse policy to staff. We provide a service where we care for the most vulnerable, and we cannot risk that anyone be under the influence of either alcohol or drugs. More importantly, the policy is not aimed at helping people out, but rather offering support where people have an addiction problem. And that is why it is imperative that we work with such as this response and the community counseling service work as these services will offer support. Finally, Mr. Speaker, I'm responsible for the funding of many charities and community bodies. I'd like to refer to the clubhouse, and I will echo what the Minister for Health said yesterday and the wonderful job that this organization is doing. We work very closely with them and support them. Last year, we provided them with temporary accommodation and rescued them from the dilapidated premises they have been allocated at the top eight, which, quite frankly, Mr. Speaker, were abysmal. And this has made all the difference to the people to whom they provide a service. But we are working together towards other premises. Mr. Speaker, I would like to take this opportunity to thank all the charities and community organizations who work with me. I will not list them all, given that there are so many. But because they know that my door is always open, I am grateful for the meaningful engagement as we progress to improve services in consultation together. And I would also like to thank both unions for the work that we've done together this past year. Mr. Speaker, this budget shows a real investment in services with tangible results. But the job is not easy, as I'm still dealing with many skeletons and gaps and problems inherited in the service. But a lot of progress has been made, and this is thanks to the dynamic teams that work with me and support me. Were it not for them, the changes and improvements to the service that I have referred to will not have been possible. I particularly want to thank my ministerial, the team in my ministerial office for all the work that they do continuously. Mr. Speaker, we will not lose sight of all that still needs to be done, and we will not take our foot off the pedal. It is full speed ahead for us as we continue to meet all our manifesto commitments, as well as develop other necessary initiatives. Mr. Speaker, we will continue to deliver.
The Honourable Isabella Lohan.
Mr. Speaker, it gives me great pleasure to address Parliament on the budget for the third time as a position spokesman for health, social services and civil contingencies. It is a duty and an honour for us on the opposition benches to contribute to and vote on this vital discharge of the responsibility of Parliament. Firstly, it is with an air of sadness that I shall broach the subject of the City Fire Brigade, and I find that I have to very precisely repeat my budget message of last year on the non-delivery of three key manifesto commitments. One, a new much-needed relocated fire station, so again there is no budgetary provision for it in this year's financial estimates book. But at least, Mr. Speaker, we have a new park. Two, the implementation of the review by Sir Ken Knight, the UK government's chief fire and rescue advisor, of a new vision for the holistic operation and management of Gibraltar's fire service. Let us not forget that despite all the government's proclamations on publishing reports and transparency, we are still waiting 19 months later to see this audit review report of the City Fire Brigade, which Sir Ken Knight conducted. And it still behoves the Chief Minister to have described us at the last budget about raising concerns for their non-publication of this report and five others, which they have still kept secret. The members of the government benches used to make the same political play of the GST government's admission to publish the whole of the King report. However, Mr. Speaker, it appears once more that this is a case of do as I say and not as I do. This government continues to refuse to publish reports commissioned by them and paid for by the taxpayer. So much for the new dawn, Mr. Speaker. And three, what about the delay in going live with the medical priority dispatch system, an essential proof of the patient triage system which can ensure that emergency ambulances are not called to incidents that are not emergencies, thus surprising those who really need them? And this has lately become an all too regular occurrence. We have many reports of incidents where ambulances are called out to non-emergencies in order for patients to get seen quickly at A&E, avoiding the unfortunately extremely long waiting time which aren't otherwise being counted. We also have reports, Mr. Speaker, of genuine emergency patients having spent up to half an hour calling for an ambulance because all three are unavailable, attending to other patients. All these crucial commitments are still pending and still wanting, and I say sadly, because every fire officer and employee from the department I've spoken to are deeply disappointed and disillusioned by the empty promises of this government. Our City Fire Service is a vital service. It is an essential service in our community, and they deserve better, but are ultimately being failed by the government that, let's not forget, offer all things to all men. No surprise is there then, because alas, Mr. Speaker, it could well be that the GSOP Liberal Alliance considers that window dressing our city and spending money on vanity pleasure, the £4 million in refurbishing on the Sixthorn Place, are more important priorities in the grand scheme of the government's limited vision. But at least, Mr. Speaker, as you may have already heard, we have a new park. With regard to the health services in Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, I must firstly commend the clinical team who have so successfully expanded and improved upon the day surgery unit of St. Bernard's Hospital. More resources and the new enhanced care system have resulted in an efficient and problem-free experience for patients. Well done, GHA. The estimated budget of the GHA for this financial year now stands at £101.6 million. In just 3 years, the health budget has increased by £12.4 million, an increase of around 14%. One might argue that in itself this is not unreasonable, but it shows investment in our community's health services. This would be fine had it been planned, but the reality is that the increase is neither planned nor controlled. Spending for this past financial year, 2013-14, has gone over budget by £5 million, Mr. Speaker. One of the 24 government heads which have gone over their budgeted estimates and suffered from a poor financial oversight by the relevant ministers because, Mr. Speaker, throwing money at problems without thinking through the consequences is how this government is managing our public finances. £5 million over budget, Mr. Speaker, no mean sum, especially when I quote the Honourable Minister for Health from his budget speech last year, who said, and I quote, "For many years, there has been a managerial failure to control spending, leading to constant overspend of millions. This government expects expenditure to be controlled, and I have taken steps to ensure that this is the case." So what happened, Mr. Speaker? £5 million overspend, which contributed to the £50 million over estimate spend this last year by all government departments, agencies and authorities together. And as the Leader of the Opposition pointed out, in order to keep these expensive departments running with nearly 600 extra public servants employed these last 2.5 years, the current expenditure now stands at £95.6 million more than in the 2011-12 financial year when this government came into power. And, Mr. Speaker, Maria Vieira, this is a government that said there was no money, that the government's public finances were in a ruinous state. Does the government think the electors are stupid? Is it the miraculous hand of God which has provided so bountifully since this government came into power? Why they perceive a relentless and populist stratagem which will mortgage the next few generations of Gibraltarians? On the subject of financial management, for a minister who claims he is listening to his staff, he's obviously not listening well enough to his finance director. On several occasions and at several GHA board meetings, the GHA finance chief has raised concerns that the senior structure of his directorate, and I quote, lacks the necessary robustness, end quote, to guarantee the proper accountability of a budget that now runs at over £100 million. A lot of management is struggling to get rid of the non-locals or GST supporters, but this is also some successive planning for the crucial department necessary to ensure budgetary control in order to avoid an overspend of £5 million. Mr. Speaker, I must emphasise that the health budget represents about 20% of this community's annual recurrent expenditure, one-fifth of everything this government spends. Lack of budgetary control has a very significant impact on overall government expenditure. Let us examine in closer detail where this over-expenditure is occurring. Sponsored patients saw a £1.9 million overspend this year, and spending is up 30% since the Honourable Minister took over the running of the GHA. But of course, they have a manifesto commitment to implement, which includes, and I quote, "We will completely review the sponsored patient mechanism," end quote. And the solution to this is that now you can go for treatment to any hospital you wish outside of Gibraltar. In 2 years, the GHA has sent sponsored patients to 89 different hospitals outside of Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, 79 of which the GHA has no service level agreement with. This means it is very difficult to keep track on patients or vouch for appropriate standards, apart from anecdotal evidence, of course. And of those 79 hospitals the GHA has no service level agreements with, 21 are private hospitals. Private hospitals, Mr. Speaker, GHA clinicians are baffled that we are paying over the standard national health rate to send 114 patients or patient episodes to these private hospitals for little clinical reason at all. These private hospitals offer care that could be offered here or in one of our tried and tested 10 hospitals the GHA has service level agreements with. Why would the minister allow this new approach in the management of sponsored cases to develop, Mr. Speaker? We are also paying Zanet Private Hospital in Dunamavana over £250,000 a month for a service which St. Bernard's Hospital could offer by bringing in, as Zanet does, the clinical specialists from the Gampalagi Bazaar and Costa area needed to treat the patients on the day. It is ludicrous that we should be paying for private healthcare rates when we could be keeping our patients in Gibraltar and bringing the specialists to them at St. Bernard's Hospital rather than continuing to send critical patients to Zanet. What could the GOC do to buy in clinical services for over £250,000 a month? Economies of scale are not the forte of this government, Mr. Speaker. Spending money indiscriminately, whether it is sustainable or not, is more their style, a style lacking courage and unnecessarily costly to our community. But at least, Mr. Speaker, we have a new park and will get a small boat marina for the bargain price of £24 million, which is 15 miles away from the Mr. Speaker. The GOK spends around £30,000 per month outside of Gibraltar for specialist imaging such as MRI, PET, bone density, and antenatal scan. Could it not be better used in training a few of our youngsters in these radiography fields to purchase the necessary equipment ourselves and employ another radiologist for our own in-house imaging services? We presently have to subject our citizens to tiresome trips to Spain for regular scanning and MRI because of the lack of vision to provide such essential services here at £30,000 a month. Financial planning and foresight is necessary, Mr. Speaker. Those economies of scale again. The Health Minister last year in his budget speech said that the GHO staff was feeling from low morale from a lack of past CSD leadership. It was seen, Mr. Speaker, that this feeling is happening at an almost imperceptible rate. The Minister will be dismayed to learn that despite his efforts, including a couple of, shall we call them, entertaining appearances on the steps of St. Bernard's Hospital for the GBC Open Day, staff morale is reported to us as being lower than ever, and a general malaise stemming from the realisation that nothing much is changing is setting in. You see, Mr. Speaker, there are several indicators of an unhappy staff. The staff which is unable to shake off deep-seated discontent. There are rates of sickness and absence, the number of complaints made by the public, where the staff are consulted in shaping their management and how top-heavy management is, and the ability to recruit and retain specialist clinical staff. A review of information provided by and described by the Minister as of little benefit and for no apparent effect, in response to questions I asked at the last session of Parliament in May, has revealed that sickness rates for all employees of the GOK is up from 2012 to 2013. In order to provide some context and better enable the electorate to assess the extent of the malaise at the GHO, according to local leading human resources specialists, the average acceptable number of days sick leave in a year for a private sector employee is 4.4. And this is set as a golden standard to benchmark against. So this is set to highlight the point in 2013, the GHK administration and support staff each suffered an average of 11.4 days sick leave a year. Medical and allied health professionals suffered 12.4 days off sick, and nurses 15.5 days off each on average for the year. The total number of days lost to sick leave during 2013 was 14,825. 14,825 days of painful cover, or where the public missed out on a service. Including the whole of the GOK staff, that makes an average of 16 days a year missed by every GOK employee, compared to a golden standard of 4.4. And these figures take into account uncertified leave, short term, and long term sick leave. The picture is indeed grim, Mr. Speaker. Another indicator to show where our health services feeling are complaints from the public. The number of formal and informal complaints is indicative of public satisfaction with the GHA, and if you look at the statistics, there are no vast improvements or reduction in complaints these last 2 years. In fact, 2014 has been actually pretty quiet for the first 5 months, with a number of formal complaints already reaching nearly half the number that were recorded for the whole of 2013. And the number of informal complaints the first 5 months of 2014 are 68, 76% of the number of reported informal complaints for the whole of 2013. Despite sickness rates and complaints, the GSC's manifesto commitment for a new GHA management structure has been implemented. This was to be the answer to all of the GHA's problems. The Honourable Members of the Fund got their way, so that the new GHA management, which conveniently removed the three non-eligible chairman and one local executive member who they had pinpointed when in opposition, has wanted out of the GHA management team, irrespective of whether they were doing a good job or not. So now we have an even more top-heavy management, Mr. Speaker. So the chief executive is not entitled to deliver on specific targets within a time frame, and this is not about the individual chosen, it is about holding the chief executive of the largest community budget to account answerable to the GHA board. An extra operational layer of three unit general managers have been added to the GHA's management structure. That's an extra group of managers for clinical and corporate governance, all added to the existing GHA senior management team. And let's not mention the new GHA strategy development group. A new management structure, Mr. Speaker, which came from a £130,000 review, the report of which is still pending for publication and public scrutiny 19 months later. Another report held in secret, Mr. Speaker. A review of the GHA and the new management, which was set up in secret, with little or no consultation with clinical staff, only with a select few, and imposed on GHA staff despite their having no sight of the review report themselves, without the possibility to contribute. Another indicator of a sick GHA, which is not healing, is how well it can recruit and retain clinical staff. For the GSSU liberals in opposition, they made much stock of the fact that the GHA, under the management of the GSC, was spending large amounts on locum or relief cover. Mr. Speaker may find it interesting that the estimate of spending on relief cover this year is £2 million, the same as the amount actually spent in 2011-2012. The Honourable Chief Minister's budget response last year accused my analysis of being incorrect with regard to locum cover, while defending his government spend of £1.5 million that year. But this is creeping up again, Mr. Speaker. Is this an indication of the government's alleged success in turning the GHA around, is attracting clinical specialists to work in Gibraltar and retaining them, or is the reality that they continue to face difficulties attracting doctors and nurses to work in Gibraltar? One thing is for sure, Mr. Speaker. If this government wants people in key positions or has to earn a promised promotion or positions to services rendered because of family connections, they will do so. Having moved the goalpost for promotion after the vacancy notice for one district charge nurse, the minister or another minister ensured that all three applicants were given the promotion, even though it was not clearly indicated, making the service top heavy with 30% of the district nursing staff as managers. And why, Mr. Speaker? Cronyism, Mr. Speaker, the GSLP logo. I can't believe it was people on the GHO proposed review panel and on every government department, agency and authority. By denying other GHO staff the right to apply for what turned out to be three jobs in community nursing, the GSLP Liberals government ensured that one of their supporters would get the job, of course, at the expense of the taxpayer. So one must ask, how the GHA is building a reputation for itself so it can attract new clinical staff? Well, unfortunately, we do not have enough to retain to fill the entire specialist clinical roles of the GHA. The advertising for these positions continues to be carried out outside of Gibraltar. For example, we have 16 specialist nursing positions currently vacant. Their advertising for them will have to go outside of Gibraltar, as we do for doctors. Yet nursing and other GHA contracts of non-locals are being terminated after 4 years of work, disregarding any verbal or written contracts entered into with them under a GHA government. We are extremely concerned by the GHA's staff and committee spaces, and he can also declare agency towards contract and supply workers with reference to variation, termination of contracts, length of short-term contracts, permanent and temporary status, and gratuities. Employment rights are changing. Employees are being targeted and discriminated against as the 9th of December has become the new 1st of July law. So staff, especially experienced and well-qualified specialist nurses on contract, are being treated as causing stress and anxiety among their work colleagues, and morale is at an all-time low. And that's on field in the Navy, I mentioned earlier, Mr. Speaker. New working arrangements are being imposed without consultation or taking into consideration the interests of the patients who use the service. Most of the employees affected by the policy of this parochial and short-sighted government are nurses in theatre, ICU, mental health and pediatrics. And continued exodus or power of these specialists, set out with this overly nationalistic and xenophobic policy, will have serious and detrimental consequences on the delivery of the high standards of care for most vulnerable patients, potentially putting them at risk. By replacing one with inexperienced staff, this undermines the available skills and will have serious consequences on the way we care for our patients and on manning levels. This is where we can perceive problems in retaining staff or recruiting new ones into these short, insecure contracts, something which has already been happening in the care agency with care workers. The behaviour of this so-called socialist government towards non-local EU contract workers who have demonstrated a high level of professionalism, expertise and commitment to a health service and care agency is disgraceful and shows little regard for the welfare of workers, Mr. Speaker. If the Bulgarians working in any EU nation in which they plan to make their home were treated in this way, we would be protected en masse outside of Parliament and Brussels, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the budget session is the opportunity for ministers to laud what has been achieved in their ministry the previous financial year and to promote their next lot of policies or initiatives for the financial year to come, supported by an estimated budget which is then approved by Parliament. So let's go back to last year's budget to see what Dr. Bodger managed to deliver on all he promised, or where they just empty words. So for the last two budgets, 2012-13 and 2013-14, the Minister for Health announced the following would be delivered within the year, but we're still waiting. The conclusion to the negotiation of the consultant's contract with a new contract drawn up and signed, despite the Minister's announcement yesterday that it was ready, we wait with bated breath. The opening of the children's primary care clinic at St. Bernard's Hospital. But did I hear the minister say yesterday that FK Children's Clinic is now open at the primary care centre? So perhaps a change of policy there. We still await the new Mental Health Act brought to Parliament. And most importantly, the number that noises about this have been made for the last 5 years. The medical complaint process was to be taken over by the Ombudsman's Office. We still await the necessary amendments to the Public Services Ombudsman Act, completed nearly a year ago, to come through Parliament. Hopefully this will be presented at the end of this year, as the Ombudsman highlighted in a media interview a few days ago. But of course, I mustn't forget an improvement in the Minister's eyes, no doubt, that the paid PHA complaint review panel was repopulated by the Minister's friends, the Minister who were happy to publicly cite aggressive, historic, and PTSD rhetoric on Gibraltar's social media. The Minister last year also promised that the new mental health facility would open up October 7 months ago, and then in December he said it would open this spring, last month. Perhaps they are reviewing the size of the rooms after many concerns were raised that they are smaller than prison cells. But perhaps we hope, Mr. Speaker, that the manifesto commitment for providing on-site social accommodation for those patients who can be cared for in the community, that means home supervision and support, is being explored. A safe protocol, a neurology service review, and a management strategy for children with autism were also meant to have happened this last financial year, 2013-14. The safe care protocol is still being developed, a neurology service is still being reviewed, and certainly not enough for children with autism has been done for parents to be satisfied that the children are being offered all the support and therapies they deserve, Mr. Speaker. And where is the final realisation that the present CHO board set up exactly the same as it was since 1987, that would even lift candour from board members of the sitting public, who receive the new governance system. The Honourable the Speaker has said the last 5 weeks said how we have people can now turn up and listen to what is going on at the GOK board meetings. He means listen to the silence, Mr. Speaker. The Speaker was ranking in prime last year that was an ex board member I should have admitted his governance needed changing. And if I may quote from my 2012 budget speech to assess the Honourable Member's memories, I said, as an ex-GHA board member, I note that the GHA board process remains exactly the same. A process I disagreed with then and one which I was hoping to change had I been given the opportunity. If there was one lesson that came out of the 2008 global recession, it was that board governance was unsuccessful in setting targets and holding chief executives to account. It was found that many boards tended to be incompetent groups of competent individuals. Their expectations, if stated at all, tended to be unclear and incomplete, and the executive report reported against few or no criteria. This was something I felt the GOK board was also guilty of. In the absence of clear instructions or clear assignment of the chief executive, we found evaluating performance was an exercise in futility. The emphasis should not be on meeting in public, it should be on empowerment of the board. Transparency is understanding how and why spending decisions are made. It is not just the production of data, presentations to the public which will be considered, and the issuing of a multitude of press releases. And I end my quote there. Mr. Speaker, this is why a GOK government with a further entire GOK board, financial managers, consultants, and doctors to exercise great control of spending cases, budgets, and service prioritization to ensure the proper balance between medical services, value for money, and budgetary discipline. With regard to the GOK government's way of leading from financial management and political interference, this is not allowed for our minister to help to cater for a clear separation of DOT activity from ministry activity. Not a day goes by when you don't hear of the minister's open door policy for all, which ends in interference of clinical decisions, helping individuals on a personal level, even though it means getting their preferred private hospital of choice. And this concern is not only levelled at the Minister for Health. We receive even more concerns in this regard of political interference and micromanagement by the Ministry for Quality, Social Services and the Elderly, where every action at every level of the Ministry is paralysed until a final decision is taken by the Minister. And the Member's Opposite Court for Peter Cavarano was there. But back to health. An example of this political interference and clinical decisions is how, for a brief while over a year ago, natural procreative technology was suddenly advocated as an alternative to IVF and then offered privately by the GHA. The minister heard this in a press release as, and I quote, government's commitment to healthcare goes beyond the NHS, end quote. I'm so surprised that I have questioned the validity of the GHA to pay for and offer such non-evidence-based, non-approved by NICE or indeed a treatment available on the NHS. Even told me unreasoned and lacking consideration and sensitivity. This has been so raised, and I know that clinical opinion and lobbying from within the GHA soon followed. Because in answer to questions last month, it seems that the Minister of Health has finally admitted the error of this political decision, and natural to what technology is not on offer by the GHA as, and I quote, access to the technology is currently under discussion. The benefit of listening to your clinicians who know, Mr. Speaker, before political interference or allowing third non-clinical parties to interfere in order to make the best clinical decisions for the patient. Now, Dr. Pedro did listen to clinicians with regard to changing the primary care centre appointment system to a one-month advance system. However, as the minister also agreed yesterday, it has not seemed to be working satisfactorily because very little else has occurred to run alongside this new policy to support it. Every day, Mr. Speaker, I have concerns raised to me about elderly citizens queuing outside the primary care centre from 5 a.m. on the first day of the month in order to guarantee that they can get an appointment to their doctor. No more appointments available after 10 or 11 in the morning on the first day of the month, leaving patients who genuinely need to review medication and control chronic conditions becoming less about their own healthcare and not bothering for another whole month. The non-answering of phones to make an appointment on the first day of the month. patients spend up to 3 hours ringing the primary care centre with no one answering the phone because all 60 lines are busy. The multiple booking of appointments with a doctor in the month by a now increasing amount of people, just in case they need one, as they know the available appointments will run out within hours. This leads to an increase of DNOs did not attend, wasted appointments, as by the time the booked appointment comes round, the patient concerned is not ill. And of course, there is no cancellation list from which patients can feed into when DNAs or cancellations occur. While a patient cannot simply call at any time of the month to see their doctor, with a commitment to provide some form of a single medical appointment within, say, 72 hours, as in the UK, is unbelievable. Is this not the definition of a medical appointment to see a sick person when they are in need? And patients who are unlucky in getting their prized appointment for the month end up in accident and emergency, swamping an overstretched service under enormous pressure, with only 7 doctors, 24/7, and often only 3 to 5 nurses. Nearly 50% of patients attending AME should be seen by a GP, of which there are 17 in the primary care centre from 8 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon. We understand that morale in AME is very low, more of the GOK sickness, Mr. Speaker. AME has more mental structure for the doctors or nurses. Doctors and nurses routinely work 12-hour shifts with virtually no break, and we see 30 to 40 patients on a night shift, more during the day. And when from 9 p.m, there is only one doctor and no backup. The risk on the state is significant, and I go back to one of the indicators. Staff turnover and sickness rates are high in AME. Patients naturally are becoming more upset and aggressive in AME, with complaints daily as to waiting times, as it is almost routine for a 3 to 5 hour wait in AME daily. The primary care centre's current system is failing the community, and the hospital, especially AME, is bearing the brunt. GPs are not given the space they need to focus on health promotion and education, which mitigates some attendance to GPs. The poor access to appointments and an AME where care could be compromised ultimately is with the patients who move out. Mr. Speaker, the government has had 2 years to audit and get the primary care appointment system and the AME service right. Vital first point of contact health services that reflect on the rest of the GHO. It is unacceptable that our therapy did need to deliver, Mr. Speaker. So let's spend less money on sending patients to private hospitals and instead invest in these frontline services. But at least, Mr. Speaker, in case you appeal to notice, and so you don't forget, we will have our service number 6 and we have a lovely new and that's what matters, doesn't it? And Gibraltar has about 5.5 GPs per 10,000 of the population. And this compares to about 7.5 per 10,000 of the population in the UK. Mr. Speaker, the solution may be that we need more GPs. In some speech before, as the leader of the opposition already mentioned yesterday, for the amount of £920,000, the amount overspent by the Chief Minister on travel and entertainment this last year, we could have employed 10 more GPs per year and the waiting list would have reduced by 33%. Mr. Speaker, along with the mental health facility at the former Royal Naval Hospital site, we also await the date of birth for the opening of the Alzheimer and Dementia Facility later this year, perhaps. The facility, which cost £12.1 million on converting the site, was nearly ready to open with the government of the project over. For 16 months, the site ceased any activity, and now, after another £30.5 million to convert the conversion, the two facilities are ready, and we must be awaiting, until later this year, the completion of the Dementia Daycare Centre, which is not a new concept, by the way. There's more funding needed for that before the site is opened. £30 million and counting. The wonderful changes and avoidable delays, Mr. Speaker, in Arbia, we know. Notwithstanding the record devil-maker spending spree of this government, there is still no provision in the estimate for extra staffing to man the site, despite the training. The dates for these new facilities, first 18 months ago, then a year ago, then 6 months ago, were all expected opening dates. When will these two facilities finally open, Mr. Speaker, and at what final cost? The SNP talk includes no funding for the running and manning of the new facilities. Does this mean we may need to wait another year before the facilities fully open? Can the government dare to ask if you already extra almost 600 public sector workers have been employed since they came into power? Or does the government need to rein in overspending, as the Care Agency has also overspent its budget this last financial year by 3.7 million, by 17%? Perhaps, Mr. Speaker, the knowledge that the moment these facilities are filled, one of the acute wounds that's been done at hospital will again fill with elderly long-stay patients awaiting a care bed. As the Peter Caruana predicted many a time when the then Federal Health Minister Neil Costa complained about the bed situation, is this what is stopping the government from opening facilities? Or maybe there is no more money to employ the staff to run these facilities. We wait patiently. There certainly seems to be money to build a £24 million small boats marina, Mr. Speaker. Another site that was ready for use when the government came into power was a former John Mackintosh spring home. It has taken 2.5 years, another reconversion, and another £4 million to finally release the property to social use. Mr. Speaker, forward planning and vision are not strength of this government, more like making it happen as we go along. Well, at the last of the past project session, Mr. Speaker, the Municipal Social Services said that under her work, through constant reviews and working closely with management, the Care Agency is much less of a beast than when she inherited it. From where we are, it seems that this beast is still alive and kicking, because after the DHA, there are certain indicators which demonstrate the low morale and unhappiness within the agency. Sickness rates, turnover of staff, and recruitment and retention of staff all point to this. Like other DHA staff, sickness rates among elderly care nurses this last year was higher than for 2012. And it's an average of 8 days each year, and that is not taking into account short-term sick leave or uncertified leave. When compared to the human resources gold standard of 4.4 days, there are twice as many elderly care nurses are sick than really should be. Another indicator is the high turnover of staff of the Care Agency and Social Services Department, which over 2.5 years has seen 64 people resigning under the government's watch in what is now the trained beast. In comparison, 69 GHA staff resigned in that period, in an authority with a third extra staff employed there than in the Care Agency. In the Care Agency, the loss of average, since this administration took office, of constant 2 members of staff a month. These include 44 care workers, 15 who work for the elderly, and 29 within other areas of the Care Agency. 6 social workers have also resigned from their position. This demonstrates a high level of dissatisfaction and no morale at the Care Agency, especially when the children and families team has been under immense pressure to cover caseloads and effectively undertake the full range of essential tasks necessary for the well-being of our most vulnerable. The persistent loss of staff has also required a high number of supply care workers from private sector providers, filling in the gaps in order to provide cover and a service to our most vulnerable. Even these private carers are not lasting long in working for the Care Agency. Difficulty in recruiting and retaining staff in the Care Agency also extends to these private care providers. The result is that many vulnerable people have been deprived of the benefit of a close working relationship with the workers they relied and depended upon. Stability, continuity of care, familiarity and security with a regular group of carers is constantly under threat. For the Minister to have argued that staff turnover was applied during the GSC's time in office is nonsensical, because nothing has changed and it flies in the face of the taming of the beast that was the Care Agency. Last budget, Mr. Speaker, the Minister claimed that the Children and Families team was developing an adoption and fostering policy and that they were undertaking a review of the adoption. Despite the commitment to such a review, in 2.5 years, there have only been 7 adoptions and 7 foster placements. Most worryingly, the 7 foster placements took place in the first 6 months of this government's term of office. There has not been even 1 foster placement in the last 2 years. Worrying because there are many families in Gibraltar willing to provide a safe and stable environment for children and young people during a difficult time in their lives, and who, for whatever reason, cannot be looked after in their own home. Such a vital service as this, which the care agency should be committed to in terms of training and supporting adults as potential foster carers, has not been happening, and it means we are denying our most vulnerable children the breathing space to get away from a very difficult life. The children and family team has been so overstretched and under pressure, they did not have the time or the will to offer this vital service. We now hope that the extra social workers will pick up on the slack, and we look forward to learn more of any new measures with regard to fostering. Again, as announced at the last budget in September, there is still no news on legislation to get those who work with children in the voluntary sector. There is no news on talent and behaviour units or funding provision for it in the estimate book. It is good that our elderly are being provided with new facilities and options for domiciliary care and residential services, but it should not be at the expense of those vulnerable children who cannot defend themselves and who must rely on the state to make the proper and full provisions at their disposal and on their behalf. Another vulnerable sector of our community, the disabled, are still waiting for the government to urgently honour, as their charity representatives described it, their manifesto commitment, which said that in their first year they would legislate to further protect disabled people using the terms of the UN Convention as a model. The Minister has recommitted to this today. Let's see how it is enacted later this year as announced. And despite physical improvement in Gibraltar to those with disabilities, there is still a way to go. Representations to us from those charities and those with mobility issues claim they are unhappy with the access from ramps on the beach to get to the seashore. They are unhappy that the disability stands at the Cavalcade and National Day do not cater for the families of those disabled to join them. I'm unhappy that there still is no appropriate audited supported employment which actively and appropriately transitions those with special needs from education to employment and adult life, such as Project SET, a pioneering model that the Disability Society advocates. However, with this government's post-op record on focus on accredited training, audit to the prejudices, schemes on the future job strategy, which my honourable friend, Mr. Rufino, will have some more to say on during his intervention, Mr. Speaker, I am not surprised that a certain employment scheme also leaves much to be desired. One thing is today, and we are training day here, holding a conference day there, raising awareness by handing out leaflets, Mr. Speaker. The other is actively working together with groups and people who know what the real issues are in order to design the services and provisions that really matter and that can make a difference in the lives of those with disabilities. And again, Mr. Speaker, the Minister for Equality announced the setting up of a domestic violence forum last year, which does not yet exist, despite the Minister stating it did so in answer to Parliament questions. This forum was to make recommendations and action initiatives that would come from them in order to tackle this scourge. I now look forward to any initiatives coming from the now set-up forum, which will be set up because last year, 55 incidents of domestic violence were reported to the police, and in the first 5 months of 2014, there were already 84 cases reported against persons ranging from the age of 13 up to 76. About half of the cases will be legally pursued, Mr. Speaker, ending up possibly in persons' trial. But more frightening is that these are only the number of reported incidents. The dark figure of unreported crimes can be anything from 3 to 5 times that figure, especially with domestic violence. It is to all these voiceless and frightened victims that we have a responsibility to react and to make a difference. And as the Minister said in the press release last year, to ensure that such violence is entirely eliminated in Gibraltar, end quote. And which is why I welcome the psychological support for victims and any new preventative measures that may put in place. In that same press release for the International Day of Eliminating Violence Against Women, the Minister for Equality also says that, and I quote, this is not a partisan issue, and I trust that we'll be able to count on the support of the opposition for our work on this front, end quote. So they do have our support, Mr. Speaker, and we would like to hear the work that has been done in this area and to contribute where we can. But no one facing the notion for women's equality is just a claim for the Ministry of Equality. The Equal Opportunities Commission is still three words on a manifesto page, despite a commitment today that it will be created sometime this year. The ideas, pilot projects, and reforms remain elusive, despite press releases of the Minister attending Women's Conference here, another somewhere else in the world, another one somewhere else. The ideas are not brought back to Gibraltar yet. They remain abroad in those elusive conferences among those hallowed groups. Interestingly, while the Minister participated in the British Islands and Mediterranean region, Commonwealth Women Parliamentarians inaugural conference, her contribution was linked to the participation by women in politics to push for increased representation. She highlighted the critical role that white women parliamentarians can play in inspiring other women to enter politics. Let us hope that this is the case. If not the Minister's words on Women's International Day of, my aim is to mobilise meaningful change where this is necessary in order to achieve gender equality, end quote, are not just empty words. So we look forward to the conference early next year and to see what comes out of it. Mr. Speaker, on the 9th of December 2011, Gibraltar experienced a new dawn. Dawn gave way to a cloudy day and the sun had scarcely shone in this community since. Hanging about this community in the dark cloud of fear, control, and secrecy which engulfed Gibraltar as the GSLP Liberals' way begs once more into our society. Their answer to everything, as they figure out what they are doing, is to spend, and of course to blame the GST. The GST could have done it in the last 16 years, arguments no longer rested with the electorate. So much had to be done and was achieved by the GST to pull Gibraltar out after 1996. And of course, more remains to be done. But financial government is now the responsibility of this government. They are spending money with reckless abandon, having inherited the GST's golden legacy, Mr. Speaker. So they don't seem to realise that Gibraltar's public finances are not a bottomless pit. What money we have because we still, as a community, have resources available for the government to spend. But one thing is clear, out of control spending must not be allowed to continue unabated. As my friend, the Honourable Leader of the Opposition, has stated time and again, including yesterday, the channeling of public money by government to a private company is a free investor whatever an advice credit to decide, and then use its private commercial status to hide its activities from public scrutiny is scandalous and an aberration of the very concept of democracy and private investment. This goes against all that European governments, in particular that of David Cameron, are successfully fighting to stop. This is a very worrying cornerstone of the government's general modus operandi and more akin to the government of so-called banana republics than a community member of the European Union. Even more seriously, it is a contemptuous affront and disrespect to the people of Gibraltar. However, thankfully for Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, the sun has now begun to set on the government's term of office, and as dusk approaches, the winds of opportunity are starting to blow. The winds of change, like a first destiny at the spell of Maggie Levanta on a sunny August morning, will soon rid Gibraltar of the transient, vigorous, and hopefully short-lived leadership, in inverted commas, of this community by the GSLP Liberals, and after him, the dawn of a new GSLP government when the treatment of their period is not
given the presence of the Minister in Gibraltar, I now need to recess the House until 6:30 and invite members to return then. They can in the interim go outside where the sun will often have kept with standing very brightly indeed, and there was a very fresh brilliant wind.
The House will recess this afternoon at 2:30, and I think the Honourable Mr. Gibraltar will take the floor.